The world waits for Israel's response to Iran's attack.
We will respond the way that we will choose, at the time that we will choose.
Plus, President Biden meets the Prime Minister of Iraq.
Simply put, our partnership is pivotal for our nations, for the Middle East, and I believe for the world.
And later, President Volodymyr Zelensky has thoughts about Allied cooperation for the air defense of Israel. And the civil war in Sudan is a year old, with no sign of slowing down. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A UN-mandated commission of inquiry that probes violations of international human rights law is accusing Israel of actively obstructing its efforts to collect evidence from the victims of the attack by Hamas in Israel on October 7th. Chris Sidoti is a member of the UN Commission of Inquiry.
So far as the government of Israel is concerned, we have faced not merely a lack of cooperation, but active obstruction of our efforts to receive evidence from Israeli witnesses and victims to the events that occurred in southern Israel.
He appealed to the government of Israel as well as victims and witnesses of the attack to aid the commission in conducting its probe. In response to Sidoti's comments, the Israeli diplomatic mission in Geneva said it had been carrying out its own investigation into the crimes and said that representatives of the UN and other institutions had been to Israel and met with survivors and victims. Following Iran's massive attack against Israel over the weekend with hundreds of missiles and drones, the world is anxiously awaiting Israel's response. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari is a spokesperson for the Israeli military.
We will respond the way that we will choose, at the time that we will choose. We don't just have offensive capabilities who were proven on Saturday night. We have very good. We don't just have defensive capabilities who were proven on Saturday night. We have offensive capabilities, and we will know what to do and when to do and how to do.
International pressure is building on Israel to hold back in responding to the attacks, but many Israelis are calling on the government to retaliate forcefully. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Iran's attack with hundreds of missiles fired simultaneously was unprecedented. So was the international cooperation to intercept them, with the U.S., Jordan, and Britain working together, say Israeli security officials. As the international community urges restraint, some in Israel say the Jewish state must respond. Brigadier General Yossi Cooperwasser is a former senior military intelligence official.
I think that we cannot leave this open file without some retaliation. But the kind of retaliation is going to be measured in the sense that Israel doesn't want to lead to a regional war.
Israeli media reports say two former chiefs of staff in the war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, wanted to strike back at Iran while the Iranian attack was underway. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said no. Other Israeli intelligence analysts say the damage was limited, and Israel can choose not to respond further. Seema Shine, an Iran specialist and former Mossad official, says Israel should build on the international cooperation against Iran.
Yeah, I'm sure Israel will be able in the future to retaliate in Iran in a different way. We have a lot of capabilities, and I think it will be much more devastating for the Iranians if Israel succeeded, and Israel has to contribute to that in order that it will work, succeed to change the architecture of the Middle East in a way that will be understood that Iran is with its proxies, but all the others are actually cooperating against Iran and its proxies.
Iran's attack came as Israel is under growing international criticism for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza that has left hundreds of thousands of Palestinians facing famine. The U.S. has been pushing Israel to accept a ceasefire that would lead to freedom for the remaining 129 Israeli hostages that Hamas militants took hostage on October 7th, although it's not clear how many are still alive. There is concern in Israel that retaliating against Iran could lead to even more pressure on Israel to withdraw from Gaza before it has reached its goals. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Israeli leaders say they will respond to Iran's aerial attack on their nation in a manner and at a time of their choosing. Iran and its regional proxies fired more than 300 drones and missiles toward Israel, with most being intercepted by Israeli and allied forces. Iranian officials are warning Israel against a counterstrike and vowing a quicker and tougher military response to any such Israeli action. Avi Melamed is a former Israeli intelligence official and head of a nonpartisan research group called Inside the Middle East. My colleague Michael Lippin asked him what kind of Israeli response he thinks we're most likely to see.
Well, look, I think it's important to understand what are the guiding lines of possible Israeli action. And there are a couple of things that I think are very relevant in that regard. First, it has to be coordinated with the United States. It has to be something that will, on the one hand, be powerful enough to send a very, very strong message across the Middle East, basically making clear that attacking Israel is something that has a very significant price tag. But at the same time, it has to be something not too much painful to the point it will cause the Mullah regime to react and actually generate a process of potential further escalation. So it has something that has to include all those components and others, obviously taking into consideration other things, operational, intelligence-wise, and so on. But I think that in the end of the day, these are the, I would say, guiding concepts that will shape the possible Israeli reaction. So when I look at all those components, I tend to incline that it will be very likely that there will be a series of covert but significant Israeli attacks against Iranian assets.
When you look at Iran's warnings about what it would do if Israel strikes back, there have been a lot of verbal threats that we're going to respond quickly, harder than before, in a way that Israel's not expecting. What can you infer from these verbal warnings and from Iran's other actions about how Iran might respond to an Israeli attack?
Well, similar to Israel, I would say that Iran is also subject to a set of calculations. I would say that at this point, the Iranian threats are not negating those threats, because we know that the Iranian has the capacity and they have the willingness to do that, and we just had an example of that. Without negating the seriousness of those rhetoric, I would say that at this point, it seems to me like those statements are more aimed to trying to deter or to prevent what seems to be like almost an imminent Israeli reaction, or at least try to hint to Israel what could be the nature of an Israeli reaction that Iran could live with, sort of speaking, and not necessarily feel that it has to react. But of course, we know that Iran also has the network of proxies across the region, that Iran could continue and further intensify the use of those proxies as they have been doing so far in a situation of a potential Israeli attack against Iranian assets. So I would take the Iranian rhetoric seriously. I would look at it at this point as something that mostly aims to try to deter Israel from potential attack, and maybe some sort of an Iranian signal to Israel that Iran could live, sort of speaking, with some sort of an Israeli action, but not something that will put the Iranian regime in a position where it will feel that it has obliged, actually, to react to a possible Israeli reaction.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Avi Melamed of Inside the Middle East. And in related Middle East news, President Joe Biden hosted Iraq's prime minister on Monday, but all eyes were on Iran, whose weekend attack of Israel has amplified concerns of a wider regional war. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Iraq's leader already had lots of ground to cover with President Joe Biden before this weekend's stunning Iranian attack on Israel raised fears of a wider regional war. Even though the U.S. is describing the aerial assault as a failure, Iraq's leader acknowledged that the conflict between Israel and Hamas is a major concern in the region. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani says Iraq is eager about stopping the conflict that started October 7th.
We are actually very eager about stopping this war, which claimed the lives of thousands of civilians, women, and children. And we encourage all the efforts about stopping the expansion of the area of conflict.
The two nations have a delicate relationship after decades of U.S. military involvement in Iraq. U.S. anti-aircraft assets in northern Iraq were used to shoot down some of the Iranian missiles. Biden said Iraq, a longtime adversary of Iran, has a role to play in maintaining peace.
Simply put, our partnership is pivotal for our nations, for the Middle East, and I believe for the world.
Earlier Monday, al-Sudani's deputy met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and both hailed the regional cooperation that thwarted the attack and urged de-escalation.
And I think what this weekend demonstrated is that Israel did not have to and does not have to defend itself alone when it is the victim of an aggression, the victim of an attack. In the 36 hours since, we have been coordinating a diplomatic response to seek to prevent escalation. Strength and wisdom need to be the same sides, the different sides of the same coin.
Mohammed al-Tamim is Iraq's deputy prime minister.
We call on all parties for self-restraint and respect the rules and also international norms that we set. وإيقاف وتيرة التصعيد حفاظا على استقرار وأمن المنطقة واحترام
قواعد العمل الدبلوماسي والاتفاقيات الدولية المنظمة لذلك. No major bilateral moves were announced Monday, but analysts say there are things Iraqi leadership can do. Daniel Byman is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Iraq needs to make its preference for reduced escalation clear, and that's both talking to the Iranians, but also talking to other Arab states and talking to the United States. That this is negative from Iraq's point of view, and that it wants all the powers to take responsible action to try to reduce escalation.
As Israel mulls its response, regional actors are not sitting still. On Monday, Iraq's president met with the king of Jordan. According to Jordan's royal court, they spoke about the dangers of this conflict escalating further. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll hear from the Speaker of the House in a moment. He's got a plan that will let the House of Representatives finally vote on aid for Ukraine, Israel, and others. And speaking of Ukraine, President Zelensky has praised international allies for coming together to help Israel defend itself from an Iranian attack. This at a time when his country is also seeking international help for defense from air attacks, and his weapons supply is running low. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
In his latest evening address, President Zelensky praised international allies for helping Israel to destroy Iranian drones and missiles that were targeting critical and military infrastructure during the attack on April 14th.
The entire world witnessed Allied action in the skies above Israel and neighboring countries. It demonstrated how truly effective unity in defending against terror can be when it is based on sufficient political will. Israel is not a NATO member, so no actions such as triggering Article 5 was required. And no one was dragged into war. They simply contributed to the protection of human life.
Zelensky suggested the situation in Ukraine would be completely different if Ukraine received similar support from the allies.
Shahed's drones in the skies above Ukraine sound identical to those over the Middle East. The impact of ballistic missiles, if they are not intercepted, is the same everywhere. European skies could have received the same level of protection long ago if Ukraine had received similar full support from its partners in intercepting drones and missiles. Terror must be defeated completely and everywhere, not more in some places and less in others.
Meanwhile, the situation in the Russia-Ukraine front line is escalating. According to the Institute for the Study of War, Ukraine suffers air defense, artillery, and manpower shortages. Institute for the Study of War reports that Russian forces are currently capitalizing on Ukrainian material shortages resulting from the lack of U.S. security assistance to make tactical advances. Experts believe the future Russian assaults may be able to achieve more significant and threatening gains, particularly west of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region, should the U.S. continue to delay assistance to Ukraine. Ukrainian officials share similar views. Recently, President Zelensky and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, Oleksandr Sirsky, reported complications of the situation at the front in recent days, especially in the Donetsk region. Zelensky said that if the U.S. Congress does not vote to provide support to Ukraine, it will have no chance of winning the war. As an example, he said that the Russian forces managed to destroy the Trypilla thermal power plant in the Kyiv region last week because Ukraine had completely run out of missiles. Zelensky reported that 11 missiles were targeting the plant. Ukraine shot down 7 of them, but another 4 destroyed the station because Ukraine had no more missiles to protect it. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Military commanders say they urgently need additional aid, including advanced weaponry, to regain a strategic advantage against the more powerful Russian forces. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze reports.
The battlefield landscape in eastern Ukraine has significantly worsened in recent days. In a social media post on Saturday, Commander-in-Chief of Ukraine's Armed Forces, Colonel General Oleksandr Sirsky, said the situation on the eastern front has deteriorated as Russia intensified its effort to gain more Ukrainian territory. Mark Weiger is a defense expert with the Center for European Analysis. He says Ukraine needs even more ammunition now, as Ukrainian forces are barely able to hold the front.
Unfortunately, Ukraine doesn't have enough ammunition to shoot back, and therefore the situation now is a bit pessimistic, especially given the delays, the shameful, I would say, politicking in the Congress of holding the promised $60 billion that are vital for the survival of Ukraine.
Faced with shortage of soldiers and ammunition, the Ukrainian parliament last week passed a long-debated bill that will make it easier to identify men who are eligible for the draft. In early April, Ukraine lowered the conscript age from 27 to 25. Officials have expressed concern about Ukraine's ability to keep fighting on the front line and across its territory.
Solomia Bobrovska is a member of Parliament's National Defense, Security and Intelligence Committee.
I see what's going on with the Kharkiv and Sumy region, and that's my the biggest, I would say, scare. And I'm afraid of they can attack on that direction.
And she expressed concern about Russia's increase to attack Ukraine's critical infrastructure.
That would be enough just to destroy totally the infrastructure, energy, and so water supplies, gas supply stations, and so on. That would be enough, and people have to leave Kyiv then, because that's the children, that's the schools, that's their jobs, works, and so on and so on.
Former education minister Anna Novosad and her foundation Save Ed are working to rebuild schools. She says even under constant threats, Ukrainians are undeterred.
No one is going to give up. People are still defiant, and people are defiant about defending their country. And the polls show that a lot of Ukrainians, the prevailing majority of Ukrainians, are not ready to give up an inch of territory for any compromises that might be there on the table.
Adrian Bonnenberger is a U.S. veteran who trained Ukrainian defense forces at the beginning of the full-scale invasion. He expressed concern about waning U.S. support and Ukraine's future.
I think what will happen is Ukraine will retreat more. They will have to fight more on the defense. Many more soldiers will die. Ukraine will keep fighting because for them they have to. Russia just wants to kill Ukraine and destroy it, and destroy Ukrainians. For America, as an American, another really bad thing that will happen is people will lose trust and faith in America. People will say that America's word doesn't mean anything. It left Afghanistan. It's abandoning Ukraine.
Some U.S. lawmakers argue America should prioritize domestic matters like border security over the war in Ukraine. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Kyiv.
As you've heard, Mike Johnson, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, has so far refused to allow a vote on a bill that passed the Senate that will, among other things, give billions of dollars in aid for Ukraine and Israel. Speaker Johnson is walking a tightrope. Many conservative Republicans, including presidential candidate former President Donald Trump, are against sending more money to Ukraine. They feel that the money could be better spent on domestic priorities. However, sending aid to Ukraine and supporting European defense against Russian aggression is a popular idea among the American people. Johnson held a press conference Monday evening to explain how he thinks he can make it work.
We have terrorists and tyrants and terrible leaders around the world like Putin and Xi and in Iran, and they're watching to see if America will stand up for its allies and in our own interests around the globe, and we will. What I presented to the conference tonight is our play call on this. What we'll do is bring to the House floor independent measures. We won't be voting on the Senate supplemental in its current form, but we will vote on each of these measures separately in four different pieces. We will vote on the Israel aid, on the aid to Ukraine, on the aid to the Indo-Pacific, and then another measure that has our national security priorities included, and that has some of the things with regard to the loan lease option and the Repo Act and some other sanctions on Iran and other measures that we've been talking about here for quite some time. We'll also allow for an amendment process on the floor so that the regular processes and orders of the House can play out. Every member ultimately will be able to vote their own conscience on all of these matters, and everyone have an opportunity to weigh in and bring the amendments that they think are suitable.
By splitting the Senate's bill into four smaller ones, Johnson is allowing the most conservative members of his caucus to vote against aid for Ukraine, though it would likely pass a vote in the full House. And finally today, 1 year since war erupted between the Sudanese military and the notorious paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, millions are on the verge of famine. And the UN Secretary General warns that the conflict might spread. VOA's Lori London has the story.
Aid workers describe a neglected but devastating conflict in Sudan that has destroyed homes and infrastructure, created the world's biggest displacement crisis, and killed thousands of civilians.
Over 8 million people have fled their homes in search of safety, 1.8 million to neighboring countries. The latest reports of escalating hostilities in El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, are a fresh cause for deep alarm.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday that indiscriminate attacks could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Aid convoys have been targeted, humanitarian personnel and warehouses have been attacked, women and girls are subject to rampant sexual violence, and meanwhile, the impact of the conflict is spilling across borders.
And according to Guterres, the main problem is clear.
There are two generals that have opted for a military solution, and they have until now obstructed all serious efforts of mediation. All these efforts failed for a very simple reason, because the two parties have made a bet, and the bet is to win militarily. And for that, mediation is irrelevant.
Efforts to help millions of people driven to the verge of famine by the war have been held up by continued fighting, restrictions imposed by the warring sides, and demands on donors from other global crises, including in Gaza and Ukraine. The UN has said nearly 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, need aid. International donors met in Paris on Monday to pledge humanitarian support for Sudan. At the aid conference, French President Emmanuel Macron said 2 billion euros had been raised for Sudan. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.